Well, I am a person who grew up in church. Are some of you like that? My earliest memories were at Gashland Baptist Church in Kansas City. In fact, I can say that my upbringing in church left a mark on me. If you look on my hand here, I have a scar from when I was 3 years old in Sunday school, and they had a popcorn popper in Sunday school, and my hand touched the popcorn popper. So I'm like scarred for life, basically, by all the Sunday school training I got. But the truth is, I'm really grateful for it. I'm so grateful to have grown up in a home where the Bible was known and loved and cherished. But I would also say that my Sunday school story and my vacation Bible school Bible story knowledge has not always served me well. Because for most of my life, I haven't understood how any of all of those individual stories fit together into any kind of cohesive whole. And what that meant for me was that most of those individual stories, you read the story in the Bible and immediately try to draw from it something about how to live and how much I ought to have faith like that person or not be disobedient like that person. And so because I didn't understand the larger story that so many of these individual stories fit into, that meant I all often misunderstood the smaller portions of the scripture. So at one point, maybe about 10 years ago, I began to listen to teachers and preachers who began to unfold the Bible story as one larger story. And that began to make me realize I needed to like go back to kindergarten in terms of the Bible to understand the Bible. Sometimes we'll hear someone say that you could tell the story of the Bible in four words. And I imagine there are some people here who could do that. Are there? Can you raise your hand if you know how to tell the Bible's story in four words? All right, so what would those four words be? The first one? Creation. Second? Third? Now, how about the fourth? Okay, I'm hearing different ones for that one, right? So certainly we'll agree on creation. I read a while ago this a theologian who said he didn't want to call it the second one the fall, but he called it rebellion. And I kind of liked that because it like puts the responsibility on Adam and Eve rather than like, oops, I fell, right? So I like that. Creation, rebellion, certainly redemption. But I heard some of you, and I hear this oftentimes, and I said it this way for a long time, to call the fourth one restoration. But I want you to think about what that looks like. If it is creation, fall, redemption, restoration. What that's saying is that the aim of the Bible story is simply to get back to the way things were in Eden. And I hope to show you in I'm going to tell the Bible story this morning in two different ways, from beginning to end, right? And I'm hoping that you are going to see that the Bible story doesn't actually end simply in restoration. Will there be a restoration? Absolutely. But I like some of you said, use for that fourth word the word consummation. And I want to suggest to you the Bible story has always been headed toward consummation. From creation toward consummation. That had Adam and Eve obeyed, as good as they were and as beautiful as the garden was, the Bible story, the story God was writing in the world, has always been headed toward glory, not simply goodness. So I'm going to tell the Bible story two different ways, and we're going to begin this morning with looking at the Bible story in terms of the story of the wilderness. Now, to begin with, I want to teach you a Hebrew word, and I should probably let you know that I am like the last person in the world who should be teaching you a word in another language. I took 2 years of German in high school and then another couple semesters in college. And all the German I can remember is Ich bin, which means I am. I don't know enough German to finish that one sentence, all right? So I'm not exactly the best person to teach you a word in another language, but I have to teach you this word because it adds so much dimension to this first story that the Bible is telling that begins in the very first sentences of the Bible. You can open your Bibles with me, if you would, to Genesis chapter 1, although you probably know this first verses by memory. Our English Bible, the sentence reads this way. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep. So the Bible begins by telling us that when God created and the heavens and the earth, it says in Hebrew, it was, are you ready for the word? Tohu wabohu. I mean, it's kind of a fun word to say, isn't it? All right? Tohu wabohu, formless and void, a barren wilderness. Will you try saying it with me? It was tohu. Oh, I think you can do better than that. It was tohu, without form and void. Tohu means it was an unformed, chaotic wilderness, and bohu means empty. So right here at the beginning of the Bible, we're learning that when God created the heavens and the earth, it was initially an uninhabited wasteland, a barren wilderness. There was no shape or form to it. No life could live in it. But that, of course, is not the end of the story, because as we continue in verse 2 of Genesis, the earth was without form and void, darkness over the face of the earth, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Can you see it there? Can you see, in a sense, the Holy Spirit's hovering, fluttering over this dark, empty, unformed wasteland? He's hovering like a hen hovers over an unhatched cosmos. And he is about, God by his Spirit, through his word, is about to illumine the darkness and bring order to the chaos and fill the emptiness of his creation. So right here at the beginning of the Bible, we learn that tohu wabohu is no problem for God. He merely speaks. He works through his Spirit. And what he says, let there be. And what was dark is flooded with light. And what was chaotic comes to order, and what was empty was filled with life and beauty and purpose. Okay, so here's why you need to know this word tohu wabohu and to understand why it is such good news. And that's because while you may have been unfamiliar with the term tohu wabohu, I imagine there are some of you in this room for whom the reality of without form and void is achingly familiar to you. There may be some of you who sense that in the deepest, most honest place inside you, you would have to describe it as tohu wabohu. An empty, aching, brooding emptiness. And maybe this emptiness was brought about by loss in your life, something that was once there, someone who was once there that you have lost. Or perhaps the emptiness comes from something you have never had, that you have always longed for. And maybe you realize that in comparison to so many people, you know you have it good, and yet there is a deep and abiding, aching tohu wabohu sense of dark emptiness in your life. Well, maybe you look at this empty place in your life and your perspective about it is that you see it as your greatest problem. And I want to convince you this morning that when God looks at the empty place in your life, he does not see it as your greatest problem. He sees it as his greatest opportunity. Because God actually does his best work with empty. When he floods it with his light, when his Spirit goes to work bringing order from the chaos, and when he fills the emptiness in your life with himself, with his beauty, his life. Well, let's begin looking here in Genesis and see this story of what God does in the Bible with the wilderness in this world. First, we think about Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve had every reason to be content. I mean, their world there in Eden was filled with so much goodness. Everywhere they looked, they saw what God had spoken into being and declared to be good. He put them in a tree where he filled this garden with, it says, trees that were all good for food. All of this vegetation simply burst out of the ground. I mentioned last night, I'm not the greatest gardener. Evidently, gardening for Adam, at least initially, came very easy for him. I'm a little bit jealous of it, you know? I mean, nothing ever turned brown and died. He was never out working in the garden and had a thorn pierce his thumb and have to go search for a Band-Aid, because everything in the garden was beautiful. Adam and Eve lived there with a sense of purpose. They were given work to fill the earth, subdue it, exercise dominion to it. And so the same way that God had brought order to so much of his creation, Adam and Eve were to work to be fruitful and multiply so their progeny would extend the boundaries of Eden on the earth, filling the earth with men and women who bore the image of their creator, so that, as the prophet Habakkuk puts it, the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. So here's Adam and Eve. They had no lack in their life, no reason to be content. And yet, when the serpent came along and suggested to Eve that there was actually something out there that would make her happy that she didn't have, namely the wisdom that would come from eating from the forbidden tree, the taste experience of that particular delicious fruit, Eve allowed the perspective of the serpent to shape her perspective. And so rather than being content with all of the goodness showered on her and everywhere around her, Eve began to see an empty place in her life. Something she didn't have. An empty place in her knowledge. An empty place in her experience. And so her desire for something more, something other than what God had provided to her, along with her growing doubts about God's goodness toward her, it led her to reach out for what she thought was going to make her happy and fulfilled. And I just wonder, don't you think that first bite must have turned so sour in her mouth and in her stomach as the reality of what she had done worked its way through her? How that grab for wisdom must have seemed so foolish on the other side of it. And so when God turned from cursing the serpent toward telling her how this curse was going to impact her and Adam, it must have become clear to her that what she had looked at and seen as a delight to the eyes was actually a disaster. A disaster for her and for all who would come after her. The very things then that were supposed to bring them joy and satisfaction were now going to bring them pain and frustration. Giving birth to children and raising children in this sin-infected world was now going to be painful. Her one-flesh marriage to Adam was now going to be filled with friction. And then Adam's work that was supposed to be fulfilling was going to become frustrating. Now, Adam was always meant to till the soil, but now it's going to become painful toil as he does it. The ground is going to grow fruit, but we discover it is now also going to grow thorns and thistles that are now going to penetrate Adam's flesh. How that flicker of discontent that Eve felt in the garden, I wonder if it became a raging fire inside her once she and Adam were banished from the garden to the wilderness that surrounded the garden. And yet, I wonder also if that chronic sense of discontentment that dogged her also proved to be a grace to her. Surely it provided a constant reminder that complete and lasting contentment is found only in the life that was promised to Adam and Eve had they obeyed, had they been able to feast forever on the fruit of the tree of life. But how are they going to get it now? Angels are there guarding the way back into the garden. Well, here's how it will happen. God would make himself a way for his people to enter into a garden that is going to be even better than Eden. And he began working out this plan by calling one man to himself, a man living in Ur, named Abram. And he called him to live in the land he was going to give him. Now, when Abram entered the land, there was no angel guarding the entrance into the land. But interestingly, when his grandson Jacob left the land to get a wife, he wrestles with an angel on his way back in. But by the end of Jacob's life, his sons are not living in the land. Rather, they're living enslaved in Egypt. So what did God do? God sent a deliverer who announced to God's people that he had come down to deliver them out of the hands of the Egyptians and bring them up out of that land to a, listen to how he described it, a good, broad land flowing with milk and honey. Kind of sounds like a New Eden, doesn't it? Now, the pathway to this Edenic land took a 40-year detour in the wilderness. And it was there that the discontentment that is inherent to life in the wilderness of this world raised its ugly head. We read it in that book that's called Numbers. Is that not the worst titled book of the Bible? Who wants to read a book called Numbers? For accountants only, right? Once again, Hebrew helps us a little bit because that's not actually the Hebrew title of that book. Anybody happen to know the Hebrew title of that book? Here's the Hebrew title, In the Wilderness. I mean, who doesn't want to read that book, right? In the Wilderness. And here's what Moses tells us happened in the wilderness. It says, now the rabble that was among them, and let's just say I never want to be described that way, the rabble. Do you have any rabble here, Todd?
No,
okay. The rabble that was among them, it says they had a strong craving. And the people of Israel wept again. They said, oh, that we had meat to eat. We remember the fish that we ate in Egypt that, get this, that cost nothing. I mean, talk about selective memory, right? The cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. Now our strength is dried up and there is nothing but all of this manna to look at. Now, what's fascinating is it's not that they had nothing to eat. It's that they wanted something else to eat instead of the manna that God rained down on them every day. I mean, the reality is their stomachs are not empty, and yet they felt a sense of emptiness nonetheless. And it sounds a little familiar, doesn't it? Like Adam and Eve, who were free to eat of every tree of the garden, but there was that one tree they couldn't eat from that made them feel deprived. It's kind of like me when I go to a restaurant and I order a Diet Coke and they say, will Diet Pepsi be okay? And I say, no, it won't. Right? 40 years after the Israelites first allowed their appetites to give way to grumbling, their children are getting ready to enter into this land that God had promised to them. And it was at that point Moses explained exactly why he let his people experience that hunger in the wilderness. Here's what he said. It's fascinating. And he humbled you, he's speaking of God, and let you hunger, and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know. And now he's about to tell us why. That he might make you know that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that comes from the mouth of God. He let you hunger. He let you feel your emptiness. And why did he do this? His intention was that it would cause them to consider carefully what really would satisfy them, what really would fill them up. And you see, it wasn't merely spicy food. It was a divine word, a divine presence, a divine promise, a divine power that would enable them to live with less than everything they might want in the wilderness of this world. Have you ever thought about the emptiness in your life in this light? Do you think perhaps that God has let you hunger for whatever it is that you are so hungry for, so that you might become more desperate for Him, more convinced that He alone is the source of what can fill you up? Do you think He might be wanting to retrain your appetites, redirect them away from this world, this life, even this age, so that your anticipation of the age to come might begin to shape your perspective about what it is that you lack? As the people prepared to enter the promised land, Moses also passed along this promise from God to his people. He said, "And if you will indeed obey my commandments that I command you today, to love the Lord your God and to serve him with all of your heart and all of your soul, he will give you the rain for your land in its season, the early rain and the latter rain, so that you may gather in your grain and your wine and your oil, and he will give grass in your fields for your livestock, and you shall eat and be full. Take care, lest your heart be deceived, and you turn aside and serve other gods and worship them. Then the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and he will shut up the heavens, and there will be no rain, and the land will yield no fruit, and you will perish quickly off of the good land the Lord has given you." Sounds a little bit like you shall surely die, doesn't it? Oh, how we wished that the children of Israel had learned the lessons they were intended to learn during all of those 40 years in the wilderness. But evidently they didn't. And so rather than living by every word that proceeds from the mouth of the Lord, once they were in the land, they began to consume everything those Canaanites served up to them. And what Moses had warned them would happen if they refused to obey God, that's what became their harsh reality. In fact, God used the Babylonian army to bring judgment on their people. And what's interesting is in the wake of that destruction, this land, remember what it was? A land of what? It became a wilderness. The prophet Jeremiah describes what Israel would look like after the armies of Babylon descended on it. Listen to what he says in Jeremiah 4. He says, "I looked on the earth, and behold, it was without form and void." But you know it in the Hebrew, right? What is it? Tohu wabohu. "And to the heavens, and they had no light. I looked, and behold, the fruitful land was a desert, and all its cities were laid in ruins before the Lord, before his fierce anger." Isn't that interesting? Jeremiah borrows from Genesis 1:2 to describe the condition of Judah under the devastating destruction of the Babylonian army. It's a barren wasteland. It's empty. It's empty of beauty. It's empty of life. It's empty of joy. But thank God this is not the end of the story. And Jeremiah knew that. He was also given a vision of a day to come when God's people were going to leave behind their wilderness existence in Babylon, and they were going to come home. And here's what Jeremiah prophesied. He said, "They shall come and sing aloud on the height of Zion, and they shall be radiant over the goodness of the Lord, over the grain, the wine, and the oil, and over the young of the flock and of the herd." Listen to this. "Their life will be like a watered garden, and they shall languish no more." A watered garden, from a wilderness to a watered garden. How is this going to happen? When is this going to happen? Well, restoration began centuries later with the sound of a single voice. The voice of the messenger, John the Baptist. The voice of one crying in the wilderness. Prepare the way for the Lord. Make his paths straight. And just like it was at the first creation, the Spirit hovered and the word went out and the dark emptiness was filled with light and life. So at this dawn of the new creation, the same Spirit hovered over the dark emptiness of a virgin's womb. The Holy Spirit will come upon you, she was told, and the power of the Most High will overshadow you. See that fluttering, overshadowing this Virgin Mary? Therefore, the child that will be born will be called Holy, the Son of God. So once again, the word went out. But this time, instead of going out in creative power, it went out in human form. God flooded the world with his goodness by entering into it in the person of Jesus Christ. And Jesus Christ, the second Adam, the true Israel, he left the heavenly land of milk and honey, and he entered into the wilderness of this world with all of its thorns and thistles. And how did his ministry begin? We read this in Matthew 4:1. Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. Just as Satan had entered into the garden to tempt Adam and Eve, twisting God's word, suggesting that they should be discontent with God's provision of food, so the devil entered into the wilderness where Jesus was. And just as he had done in Eden, Satan quoted God's word at Jesus, but just like he had done before, he twisted it, suggesting to Jesus that he use his power to feed himself rather than trust in God's provision of food. He tempted Jesus to grab hold of the goodness and glory by indulging himself now rather than waiting for the glory that would be bestowed on him by submitting to the cross. But instead of falling prey to what the tempter said, like Adam and Eve did, Jesus responded, interestingly quoting the words of Moses that he said to his people in the wilderness. Jesus said to the tempter, "Man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes out of the mouth of God." Matthew tells us that after Jesus passed this test of temptation in the wilderness, it says that angels came and were ministering to him. Such a different experience than that of the first Adam. The angels had stood against the first Adam as adversaries, preventing his return from the wilderness to the garden. So such a different outcome, such a different result than the first Adam brought about. You see, because of the first Adam's failure to obey in a garden, all of humanity was plunged into the wilderness. But because of the second Adam's willingness to obey as he lived in the wilderness, the way back into a garden that will be even better than Eden has been opened up for us. Jesus began assuring all who put their faith in him of this reality even as he hung on the cross, saying to the thief beside him, "Truly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise." There on the cross, Jesus entered into the ultimate wasteland of this world, the ultimate tohu wabohu, so that you and I can enter into the abundant life that God has promised. We get a sense of this new garden life to come, actually breaking into the here and now of the wilderness of this world immediately upon the resurrection of Jesus. Here's what John tells us. He says, now in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden. And in the garden, a new tomb in which no one had yet been laid. Then John continues in chapter 20, Mary stood weeping outside the tomb, and she wept. And as she wept, she stooped to look into the tomb, and she saw two angels in white sitting where the body of Jesus had lain, one at the head and one at the feet. You see, it would seem that the empty tomb has now become the entryway into this new garden. And two angels are there to welcome all who are willing to identify with Jesus in his death and resurrection. And we read that Mary turned around and she saw Jesus standing, but she didn't know it was Jesus. And Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking?" And it reads, "Supposing him to be the gardener." Supposing him to be the gardener. And my friends, he was. He is the gardener. This was the dawn of the new creation. And the gardener was up at the crack of this dawn doing the work that the first Adam failed to do. Extending the boundaries of paradise into the wilderness of this world. And my friends, even now the new creation is breaking into the wilderness of our lives in this world. How does it happen? It happens when we identify with Jesus, when we become joined to Jesus in his death and resurrection. You see, this is exactly what Paul meant when he says, if anyone is in Christ, the new creation has come. You see, that new creation, that garden life is breaking into our lives when we become joined to the risen, resurrected Jesus. And as it changes us from spiritually dead people into spiritually alive people, people who begin experiencing in part now and in fullness forever, the unending, abundant, all-satisfying life that Adam and Eve could have enjoyed had they passed that probationary test of the tree. But I don't know, even as I'm saying, maybe some of you are thinking to yourself, yeah, that's really great and all this abundant life and this life in this garden to come. But I got to tell you, my life is still marked in many ways by wilderness, by emptiness, by discontent. Well, I got to tell you, mine too. And this reality makes us wonder if it's really possible that we could live in the wilderness of this world with any real sense of the contentment to come in the new creation. Well, I want to suggest to you this morning that the experience of the Apostle Paul, his experience of the thorns of the wilderness, as well as the contentment of the greater garden to come, would suggest it is. Will you look at that with me before we close today? All right, so turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 12 with me. 2 Corinthians chapter 12. Here is Paul. He's writing to these people in Corinth. And, you know, all of these super apostles have shown up in Corinth at the church, and they've been trying to tell the people there that Paul isn't really a reliable guy. These guys, they've got all these fantastic stories of visions and supernatural experiences. And I imagine them looking at the people there in the church there and saying to them about Paul, I mean, do you really want to have, as a pastor of the church, a guy you have to keep bailing out of jail? I mean, come on, right? Paul had experienced incredible suffering, but here, in the middle of chapter 12, in the very middle of verse 7, Paul says, a thorn was given me in the flesh. Now, what was this thorn? We don't know. You can read lots of books about it. We don't know. But we do know this. We know that the word he uses for thorn is not like the little thorn on our rose bush where we get our finger pricked. The word he's using for thorn here is more like a stake that someone would be impaled on in Paul's day. And so when Paul says he's experiencing a thorn in the flesh, he's describing an unbearable agony. Whatever this pain is, he feels pierced to the core by it. He feels pinned down by it. And in the next verse, in verse 8, we're going to find him begging God, pleading three times for God to take it away. So whatever the thorn was, clearly it brought unrelenting agony. Now, what I find fascinating about this story, and I wish I had a long time to talk about it, but you and I, we've talked about this earlier, that when we suffer, oftentimes our first question is, why? And it's fascinating to me, that's not Paul's question. Actually, Paul knows exactly why this thorn has entered into his life. Look, I began in the middle of verse 7. Look at the beginning of it. It says, "So to keep me from becoming conceited because of the surpassing greatness of the revelations, a thorn was given me in the flesh." Okay, wait a minute. So what are these surpassing greatness of the revelations? Well, we'd have to read the first 6 verses. And the first 6 verses, Paul, because of all these super apostles who've been claiming all of these great supernatural experiences, Paul feels forced into the corner to describe his own supernatural experience. He says, 14 years ago, I don't know if it was in the body, I don't know exactly, but in his humility, he says, a man who, well, he's talking about himself, he says, was caught up into the third heaven. Or look in verse 3. I know this man was caught up into paradise. He was given a personal guided tour of the new garden to come, the paradise. I mean, this is the kind of experience that could cause your head to swell with spiritual pride, isn't it? I mean, you're sitting with people around the lunch and they're all talking about, I had this happen, I had this supernatural experience. And like Paul pulls this out of the back pocket and lays it on the table. He's like, I had a personal guided tour of heaven. And evidently, Paul understands his own vulnerability to the sin of spiritual pride. And so whatever this thorn was, when he looks at it, he sees the sovereign purposes of God at work. He sees the hand of God at work protecting him from something that would be even more painful than the thorn, and that would be to use the incredible supernatural experience that he was given to make himself look good instead of make God look glorious. That, and the idea that he might do that is even more painful to them than the thorn. So he sees God's hand at work in this thorn. But it's fascinating that that's not all he sees, because now I haven't finished the verse. Look back at it. He says, I was given a thorn, and a thorn was given me in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to harass me, to keep me from becoming conceited. Now, at this point, we want to say, well, Paul, which is it? Because we tend to want to look for a singular source for our suffering. We have an experience, and we want to either say, this is God, something God is doing in my life for good, or we say, this is something evil happening to me that Satan's doing. Well, check this out. Paul looks at the thorn. He sees the hand of God at work protecting him from sin, while at the same time he sees the hand of Satan at work tempting him to sin. He sees the hand of God training him to trust him in the midst of difficulty, while at the same time the work of Satan tempting him to resist and resent God for allowing more pain to enter his already pain-ridden life. He sees the hand of God at work in his life seeking to develop his faith, while at the same time the hand of Satan seemed to diminish, even destroy his faith. But the bottom line was that Paul understood that God intended to use the thorn for a sanctifying purpose in his life. But I still appreciate verse 8. where it says he begged God to take it away. I mean, have you ever been there? Like you're experiencing something and you realize in the midst of this difficulty, I'm really experiencing spiritual growth because I'm praying more, because I'm more desperate for God to work than I ever have been before, but we're still begged for God to take away the pain. I mean, I appreciate his humanness there because I have been there. So he begs God to take it away. And then he begs again. And then he begs again. And then he hears Jesus himself speak to him. But I don't think Jesus said what he was hoping to hear. Look in the beginning of verse 9. He hears Jesus say, "My grace is sufficient for you. My power is made perfect in weakness." So here, Jesus' answer to Paul's rigorous, repeated, righteous prayer was not that he would take the thorn away, but rather that he would provide enough grace to Paul to endure living with the thorn. Paul would experience divine power. Not the way he hoped for, not the divine power of having the thorn removed, but rather divine power in it being redeemed. As we continue in verse 9, he says, "Therefore I will boast all the more gladly of my weaknesses so that the power of Christ may rest upon me." Now think about this. I mean, that can be such religious sounding words. We don't think about what's really being promised here. The power of Christ. This means he's being promised the same power that enabled Jesus to endure the cross. He's being promised the same power that raised Jesus from the dead. That's going to come, it says, to rest on him. And when Paul heard and understood these words from Jesus, it changed his perspective about the thorn. This thorn that was going to continue to be a reality in his life day by day. How does it change his perspective? Look at verse 10. He says, "So now for the sake of Christ then, I am content." What's he content with? I'm content with weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and calamities. For when I am weak, then I am strong. There it is, my friends. Contentment in the wilderness. Contentment for now in a world where thorns bring pain. Does this sound possible to you? I mean, let's be real. Does it seem possible to you that you could be content even if your circumstances don't change? Does it seem possible that you could open up yourself to receiving divine power that would change how you think about the empty place in your life? My friend, I've got to tell you that if you are weak, if you are worn out from work, worn down by criticism, weary of constant demands or disappointments, if you have come to the end of yourself, if you've finally been emptied of your own delusions of strength, you are finally in the right place for your life to be filled up with the goodness of God. You're finally fillable. You're fully dependent. There's room for the power of Christ to rest on you in such a way that it will give you strength to be content even as you continue to live your life in the wilderness of this world, in the wilderness in which he might let you hunger. When I am weak, then I am strong, Paul sums it up. That's the reality that shaped Paul's life. But you see, really, Paul's life was just being conformed to the pattern of Christ's life. Jesus, the craftsman who made the world, entered into the wilderness of his world in weakness, as an embryo in a mother's womb, as an infant wrapped in claws. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. You see, Jesus became weak. Jesus was insulted. Can anything good ever come out of Nazareth? Jesus experienced hardships. He said, "Foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." Jesus faced persecution. Then they spit in his face and they struck him and some slapped him. Jesus faced calamities. Herod sent and had John beheaded in prison. And when Jesus heard this, he withdrew to a boat, to a desolate place by himself. You see, Jesus not only entered into the wilderness of this world, the wilderness of this world entered into him. Jesus had a thorn in the flesh. He had many thorns pressed into his tender brow. And my friends, if Jesus had a thorn in the flesh, and we have said at least that we want our lives to be conformed to his life, joined to his, why are we so surprised, when even resentful, when we feel the pain of a thorn in the flesh? When we experience the agonies of life, that's just a part of living life in the wilderness. You know, people today are so hungry for a supernatural experience, are they not? Don't you know people who want to talk about dreams God gave them and personal words from God? Well, let me tell you, here is the supernatural experience that God has promised to every person in this room. Are you ready? He has promised divine power that would come down to rest on you. Sufficient grace to come down and fill you up so that you can trust him when the worst thing you imagine happens to you. So that you can be genuinely, if not yet perfectly, content. Even if he doesn't fill up the empty place in the way that you have longed for. At least not yet. My friend, the day is coming when thorns and thistles inherent in living in a world of wilderness are going to be a thing of the past. Paul writes, "For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God." That's Resurrection Day. And the Apostle Paul was allowed to see a vision of what this created world is going to be like when creation is set free from its bondage to corruption, when the creation experiences the same resurrection and renewal our bodies are going to experience, when Christ returns and raises us from the grave with bodies fit for living forever on the new earth. In the very last chapter of the last book of the Bible, which describes the first chapter of our lives, living in a new garden that we're going to be welcomed into, here's what John tells us about it. He says, "No longer will there be anything accursed. No more signs of the curse in the form of thorns that bring pain. No more death, no more pain, no more tohu wabohu. the goodness and the glory of a garden that is even better than Eden is going to extend to every corner of the earth. And the goodness of God is going to fill up every part of you so that there will be no more disappointment, no more discontentment. All of the empty places will be filled up. All of our deepest longings fulfilled. Sing this with me if you know it, will you? Guide me, O thou great Jehovah, pilgrim through this barren land. I am weak, but thou art mighty. Hold me with thy powerful hand. Bread of heaven, bread of heaven, fill me till I want no more.